Before we start our episode today, this is just a reminder. History Hack does have a Patreon account and all of your donations are gratefully appreciated. There's lots of perks on there, secret groups on Facebook. Do get involved. We would love to see more of you. Enjoy the episode today.
Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. Zach and Marcus here on presenting duties, but we are not going to be doing another episode of Sharpshooters for you today. One of those will come along in a short while. Marcus, who have we got with us today?
We've got Sam Wilson with us, Battlefield and Conflict Archaeology Specialist, who we met basically through Waterloo Uncovered, but he does many other projects. Some of them he's going to tell us about today, really. A really interesting area for military history nerds like ourselves, that it's not just any old archaeology. We're kind of getting into really specialist stuff, and that's Sam's bag. How are you doing, Sam?
I'm very well, thank you, and thanks for having me on, guys.
That was an absolute pleasure. Let's dive straight in with the basics for people. Marcus has alluded to it already. You've got archaeology and battlefield and also conflict archaeology. And these are terms that we sort of rattle around a fair bit, but folks might not be familiar with them. So what's the difference between the two or even three?
So really, I suppose conflict archaeology is a sub-discipline within archaeology as an overarching subject. Archaeology, of course, dealing with the human past, very broadly speaking. So within that, you have this section of conflict archaeology, and that deals with anything associated with conflict. So it doesn't necessarily have to be battlefields. It can be prisoner of war camps, it can be graffiti, it can be art relating to warfare, all of those kind of things. But then within the subcategory of conflict archaeology, you have this further category, which is battlefield archaeology. And that is specifically dealing with the actual sites of conflict and trying to understand them, trying to understand the landscapes that they were fought in, as well as the actual objects that were deposited during the course of that particular battle.
So is this a little bit like, well, in a sense, it is a bit like history and then military history. But what I'm curious about is there sort of beef between the different subdisciplines? You know how some military historians turn around and say, oh, military history is withering away and it's dying. And others turn around and say, no, it isn't. And there's sort of discussion about tensions. Do you get an equivalent? Is there sort of archaeology beef going on?
To be perfectly honest with you, that there really isn't that much beef in archaeology. It's ultimately a very collaborative process where I'd imagine history is can be a bit more of a solitary pursuit where you are in an archive, you're at a computer writing and so on. But archaeology, you really cannot do it on your own. You have to be part of a team, and everyone in that team will bring their own specialist knowledge and their own experience and viewpoint to that team. So, you know, it's very much the opposite, really. Everyone will happily work together very often, and that will include historians, that will include specialists from other subsects of archaeology, like environmental archaeology, for example, is very important. I don't really fully understand everything that there is to know about environmental archaeology, but I'll happily defer to someone who knows more than me, you know. So actually, I think it's most of the time, it's a very healthy and collaborative process.
Okay.
Very diplomatic answer.
Sorry.
But you're a conflict archaeologist. What do you do that people who are maybe a mainstream archaeologist don't do? What's your real nitty-gritty specialism? What's your toolkit?
Well, I suppose the main way that battlefield archaeology differs mostly is through the use of metal detectors. And traditionally, you know, there's been a bit of animosity perhaps between archaeologists and metal detectorists because of, you know, the sort of perception that metal detectorists might not record their finds properly or might sell them or whatever.
Yeah, and night hawking is a really serious crime. You know, it's doing real damage.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you are caught illegally detecting on a scheduled monument, you can ultimately get prosecuted for it. So it's quite a serious thing. And, you know, schemes like the Portable Antiquities Scheme that's been running for a good long while now, you know, is trying to address that sort of, you know, that what was a deficit and actually record things properly and so on. But the principal tool really to investigate battlefields, particularly ones where there's a lot of metal in the ground, such as, you know, Napoleonic battles, Civil War battles, you're going to be using the metal detector and you're going to be using it in a systematic way. And that's how we recover the objects and we plot them and try and understand them. But you do still occasionally come across archaeologists who are a little bit set in their ways, perhaps, and they'll see a metal detector and, you know, they'll still, for some reason, get that little bit of like, oh, I don't like metal detectors. But the reality is that it's an exceptionally useful tool, not just on battlefields, on any archaeological site, more or less, unless you're dealing with something in way back in prehistory, where there is no metal being used or very, very little of it. So I see it as just another archaeological tool. And for battlefields, it probably is the most important tool.
So for people like myself who grew up with Time Team, is this the equivalent, metal detecting, as when they always used to send out the geophys surveys and they had those really, really bad pixelated black and white blocks and someone with a grimy finger would go, that's definitely a Roman villa. And it just looked like a load of pixels to me. But they were they were finding something under the ground rather than digging out the whole field in Oxfordshire. Is that kind of the equivalent? You're starting to pin down, I know at Waterloo and Cover, you're starting to go, actually, here's a collection of French musket balls. So they're firing at something or somebody who stood in this general area. Is that how it's building up a picture for you? Or is it?
Yeah, exactly. The best analogy really is to compare it to the archaeological technique of field walking, where you will systematically walk across a field and a landscape and pick up bits of pottery and bits of tile and so on that are just lying on the surface that have been churned up through ploughing. And effectively, we're doing the same kind of technique, but just with metal detectors. And it is similar to geophysics in the sense that we're sort of covering a landscape to try and understand a wider picture. But I would say it's a bit more like field walking, in that we can't necessarily see what's under the ground. All we're doing is we're finding the objects that are what we call unstratified, which are not contained within any archaeological features. They're just in the topsoil and they've been churned around through ploughing and so on.
I'm really interested about the challenge of locating things on a battlefield, because if nobody's ever been to a battlefield, perhaps this won't have occurred to them, but they are big places. You know, they are quite simply fields. That's the reason the name, really. So trying to work out where it's worth investing the time must be hugely challenging. Is this part of where metal detecting comes in? Because it also strikes me that, yes, okay, you can cover a larger area, but, you know, if you've got a battlefield that's 7 kilometers wide, you can be in one corner. Doesn't really matter if the main action, the relevant artifacts are in another.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And there's always a lot of preliminary work that goes into, well, where do we start? And the further back in time you go, really, the more difficult it becomes. If you imagine the Battle of Waterloo, there's so many accounts written about it. And we know exactly where the battle was fought. You know, the farms are still there. The landscape is not too changed from how it was. But, you know, the further back you go, back into the 17th century or the 15th century or the 13th century, you know, the landscape has changed more dramatically. And crucially, there are far fewer accounts that are written about it. Certainly far fewer that were written by people that were there. And often the ones that do survive are written sometime after, or they have a particular agenda based on what they're trying to portray, i.e., you know, we're trying to make the victorious side look good. So we're going to exaggerate the numbers and we're going to exaggerate this and that. So you start off any project really by looking at or attempting to reconstruct the historic landscape of the battlefield. So what do we think that this looked like in whatever date it was that the battle was fought, in the 15th century or the 17th century or whatever? And that will involve a bit of map regression, looking at historic maps as far back as that can get you, as well as looking at documents about land holding and stuff like that to try and work out what land was where and how big it was and what it was used for, crucially, because you need a big area to put an army at the end of the day. If you've got lots of tiny enclosures, it's a very, very poor place to deploy an army, certainly in the medieval period. So the historic landscape is one thing. And then you need to be looking at the historic accounts of the battle. And as I said, they may be few and far between, potentially. But often they will contain certain topographic clues as to where the battle may have been fought. You know, sometimes there are multiple theories across a wide area about where it was at all, you know, and they'll say things like, you know, they were on the road or they were on the hill or they went to the north of the town. And they're never that specific, like in later periods. But there's always usually something in there that might be useful. And then kind of the third component really is anything that's been found in the area previously by casual metal detecting, by previous archaeological work, or sort of a bit of local legend as well kind of comes into it a little bit, although you have to treat that with a little bit of caution. And so all of that really builds into, well, where do we now start with the metal detecting? Or you know, if we're looking for some ditches that they dug during the battle, what, you know, where are we going to try and find them? In that scenario, we might also do geophysics to see what's there. But then we'll basically pick an area to see what's there, and we'll test it, and then we'll start revising the strategy as we go along, so based on the results. So we might go to an area where we think, I'm 100% certain that this is the middle of the battlefield, like all of the evidence pointing towards this particular location, like a good feeling about it. And then you go there, you do a load of metal detecting, a really systematic, intensive way, and you don't find anything. And then you go and I go, ah, that really was not what I expected. And so that evening you sort of think about it and you go, right, well, why didn't we find anything? Is there something in the field we're not taking account of? Like we're just dealing with a pasture field that hasn't been plowed for a very long time? Or are we just in the wrong place? Or have we misinterpreted something? Et cetera, et cetera. And then you effectively modify your strategy as you go along.
Fantastic. I mean, this sounds like real detective work, but there's some real science behind all your procedures as well. If we can just talk about that, that gives you a load of sense of perspectives and different, you know, resources and skills. So I just wondered if you could talk us through some of the scientific processes that you use on these battlefields.
I mean, I suppose the scientific process is really, they kind of come into play prior to actually the fieldwork stage. So we're dealing with stuff like LIDAR imagery, satellite imagery, sort of various mapping applications, as well as geophysics to potentially look for things like, you know, ditches if they were dug during the battle, or things like mass graves as well. The actual undertaking the fieldwork element is probably one of the least technical parts of it. You're literally just doing some metal detecting, really, is what it boils down to. And then you'll have the analysis that comes after that. So there'll be a lot of, you know, again, it's not necessarily in-depth scientific analysis. It's just looking at things very closely, really. But if you are dealing with things like human remains every now and then, which you know, you have the potential to come across on the battlefield, of course, that's a whole new level of assessment and analysis that a specialist osteologist would have to do. So we sort of typically use all the tools that archaeologists generally have available to them. And there are new techniques coming out sort of all the time. Things like LIDAR and satellite imagery, that's revolutionized archaeology in many ways.
Just explain to folks what LIDAR is.
LIDAR is basically an aerial scan of a landscape where thousands and thousands of lasers are shot down from a plane, and it will map the surface of the earth. And because of the way that it shoots all these millions of lasers, it can see through things like tree cover as well. And you can pick up very subtle undulations in the ground. So where there may have previously been some earthworks associated with the battle, or, you know, some change in the landscape, or historic field boundaries that were in use at the time of the battle, things like that. So it can help us identify landscape features that aren't there anymore, or at the very least are difficult to see at ground level, and pick them out.
That sounds incredibly detailed. Is that expensive process as well?
It used to be, because you used to have to sort of arrange it all and that kind of thing. But actually, the vast majority of the country, certainly the UK and a lot of other European countries now, are covered by freely available LIDAR. In this country, it's the Environment Agency that's made it all available. And you can literally go onto their website and download the information. You can then import into a GIS program, and you can have a look at it for yourself. Anyone can do it, basically.
I'm curious also about something that you said there about finding battle casualties, dead bodies, effectively.
Yeah.
My sense is that finding those who died in battle is actually quite rare. Is that a fair assessment? And if so, what's the reason for that, do you feel?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a fair assessment. You know, the number of mass graves that have been found on battlefields is pretty limited. You know, if you think with Waterloo Uncovered, we've been working at Waterloo now for five years, unfortunately slightly paused at the moment because of COVID. But we've done five seasons of work there. And the only burial, if you like, that we've come across is an amputation pit at Mont Saint-Jean Farm. We haven't come across a single grave of an individual, of a horse even, or indeed a mass grave. And you consider the amount of casualties that were on that field at the end of the day. It's kind of unusual in a way. With some of the earlier battles, again, it's sort of even rarer or less potential, I suppose, because the numbers will be that much smaller in most occasions. But often they were removed to consecrated ground, if that was nearby. You know, and sometimes they were interred on the battlefield, and then a few years later they were then dug up and moved. In that scenario, you could, in theory, find where the graves were, at the very least. I think they managed to do that at Towson, actually. But yeah, partly they haven't been found because people haven't really looked for them. You know, you're not really going out there with the objective of looking for a mass grave to go and dig it up at the end of the day, you know, because unless it's threatened with development, i.e. someone wants to build a industrial estate over the top of it, there's not actually any need to dig them up, you know, and there's an element of respect that has to come into it. You know, if you do come across human remains, of course, ethically, as an archaeologist, you have to deal with everything respectfully. And there's not really any need to go hunting mass graves and digging them up for the sake of it. You know, if you come across one in the course of other work, then okay, you know, you deal with it appropriately. So I think that's part of it, really. People haven't necessarily gone out to try and locate them, really, yet.
That's really interesting. Something Zach and I are very passionate about on our side things is the casualties from like kind of long or distant conflicts. And it's really interesting to hear the ethical conflict within your own mind and within the industry, I guess, the sector that goes behind that. Something you said earlier, you were saying about the dangers of assumptions. And I was wondering how it kind of balances, especially at the beginning of a project. You might have some good examples where there's a misconception, or historians who've done archive research and it's leading them down one path, and actually your work starts to disprove a point or say that maybe the battlefield wasn't in field A, it's over there at the edge of field D and it's down the road, or, you know, they didn't use, we haven't found any cannonballs, so maybe they didn't use cannons. I wonder how those kind of
things play out against the historians versus the archaeologists, I guess, or the misconceptions versus the groundwork.
Yeah, I mean, that is, as more battlefields get investigated archaeologically, that's becoming a more frequent occurrence, that where we think battlefields are, it's not quite right. You know, the most well-known example of that in relatively recent years was Bosworth. And it wasn't a project that I was part of, you know, the main project. It was led by Dr. Glenn Ford. And for years, decades, centuries almost, the site at Ambion Hill was accepted as the battlefield. And that was because lots of historians had, you know, basically said, this is where it is. And no one had really... no one had any reason to question it because no one had done any archaeology there by that at that time. So once they started the project, it took them 5 years of work, but they then found the very first cannonball from the battle, something like a mile and a half away from the Ambion Hill site. And of course, where there was one cannonball, there became two cannonballs, and eventually there was loads. It's like 40 or 50. I think it's probably about 50 now, judging by the other bits of work that have been done. And of course, you can't argue with that. You can't argue with the physical archaeological evidence in the ground. And we're starting to see a similar picture emerging with some work I'm involved with the Battlefields Trust at Stow-on-the-Wold. And it's still kind of ongoing at the moment, but we have been testing a whole load of areas around the general landscape surrounding the town, including parts of the registered battlefields, as well as other areas. And it, based on the evidence we've got at the moment, it seems that the battle is fought a lot closer into the town than has been previously thought. And that is well outside of the registered area. We need to do a bit more work to try and confirm all of this. But yeah, it's looking like potentially that's another case where the registered area is a bit wrong. And again, that's based just on some historical interpretation before battlefield archaeology was a thing, really. And it just became, well, it's just been accepted because some historians made a sort of vaguely compelling case and we just sort of went with it. So it's really interesting that that is, you know, is a thing. Some battlefields are well known, like Sedgemoor, for example. You know, everyone knows where that is. There's archaeological evidence to back it up. It's right there. But it's not always the case. That has an interesting implication in terms of the protection of battlefields. Because if you imagine development taking place on or very near to a battlefield, you might be protecting the wrong bit. You know, if your big red line is in the wrong area, and the battle's actually a mile or two away, you might just say, oh, well, it's not in the red area. It's a mile or two away. Carry on. You know, we won't put a planning condition that says you have to do a battlefield sort of metal detector survey or anything like that. We'll just sort of go, oh, well, the battlefield is 2 miles away. It's not important. And in a way, you'd be fairly justified in saying that as a planning archaeologist or whatever. But so that's why trying to actually accurately work out where these sites are is quite important, because even if the development is going to happen on these sites or parts of these sites, sometimes there's not a lot you can do about it. But the important thing is that the archaeological information is gathered in the appropriate way, because if not, it's going to get destroyed and it's information that's lost. And battlefield remains are typically very fragile as well, because they are, as I said before, unstratified in the topsoil. All it needs is a big machine to come in, and within a few seconds, it'll all be gone. So working out exactly where they are is quite important in that respect.
I mean, the implications of that, I'm just wondering, you know, you have the battlefields marked out on OS maps and other areas, and if you shift that, then you lose protection in one area, then you might never regain it in the, you know, housing crisis and all that. Could be really interesting balance. But I'm thinking of a specific example. I wonder if you can comment. I hear a lot about the battle at Battle, or should I say the Battle of Hastings.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of debate there about, did they build the church on Senlac Hill because of the battle took there, or was it where actually they rested afterwards? And I've heard that they actually haven't found a lot of finds on the hill, but they have down the road. I wonder if you ever got a personal experience of that. I think you do.
I do have a little bit of experience of it. Yeah, I was lucky to do a little bit of work there quite a few years ago now, actually, when they did the time team program looking at the battle. It was a sort of time team special that they did. And we did some work on the actual battlefield, what is, you know, by Battle Abbey. And we looked at an alternative site as well that had been proposed. The main problem really with battles of that period, you know, this is 1,000 years ago, is that most of the stuff that's going to be dropped or broken in that battle is going to be made of iron. And iron will degrade very, very badly in most conditions. It will also be broken up very easily by things like ploughing. So even if something was there from the battle, it may just be destroyed. And there's sort of other factors at play as well, like modern contamination and things like that. So we sort of tried to get around that on the battlefields below Battle Abbey by kind of stripping down these big long trenches to try and expose some slightly deeper material. And we found some medieval stuff, but we didn't find anything that was as early as 1066. However, the work was relatively limited. And just because there wasn't any evidence, it doesn't mean that there wasn't a battle there in this case. My general feeling about was it at Battle Abbey or was it not, is that it was at Battle Abbey. That's my personal opinion. I think Battle Abbey was built in William the Conqueror's lifetime. I don't think it would be down the road. I think, you know, it's a symbol, it's a statement. The high altar might not be right on the position where Harold, you know, met his end or whatever. But, you know, broadly speaking, my gut feeling is, despite the general lack of evidence, I think it's still there, really.
The geology works as well. It's just an interesting one from visiting it, knowing it quite well. It's a beautiful site. And as I often do in these things, I encourage people to visit it. It's a lovely vista and it's got a great trail. But I just wondered, if it tied into your expert assessment. So that's
great. I mean, I'm no expert in that period, really, but the theory that was put across in the programme based off of this work was that there was this sort of narrow causeway almost that was a very sensible place for the Saxons to defend. And it was sort of almost billed as an alternative site, you know, we've come up with a new alternative. But the reality of it is that it's all part of the same hill where Battle Abbey is. And as you guys will know, of course, the vast majority of battles are fought on roads or next to roads or to control roads, you know, because that's how you move armies about, you know, and you need to stop the enemy going up the road to get to the place beyond, you know. So the fact that there was this road there and there was a hill, you know, it's at the very least got all the classic elements of a battlefield of that period, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what also presents a challenge for you folks in terms of assessing the site, particularly around Battle Abbey, is that it's a building. It was at one stage a building site because they had to build the abbey. So therefore, any material would likely have been disturbed anyhow.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right there. And that's one of the key considerations that you have to take into account is any post-battle disturbance that might have gone on. You know, things being dumped in the fields, or material being removed for some reason, or even natural processes like hill wash, what we call colluvium, you know, being washed down and burying things so we can't reach them with a metal detector, basically. And part of Battle is also built up as a modern town, so you can't really explore the whole site archaeologically, even if you wanted to. So, yeah, there are all sorts of modern problems that you also have to deal with. And sometimes you only end up with these little pockets that you're really able to examine properly.
That leads me on to something else that I wanted to ask you about, which was the challenges which you talked about already, but also the potential pitfalls in your work. And I'm not sort of saying that as to try and sort of say, oh, battlefield archaeologists don't know what they're talking about. but you must be aware that there are, just as for somebody like myself as a historian who buries themselves in archival stuff, there are things that you've got to be aware of in that process about biases and reliability and whether or not you can confirm what you're pulling out of these sources. There must be equivalents for you in your line of work.
Yeah, I mean, archaeology at the bottom line is all about interpretation and interpreting the evidence that you have. It's basically storytelling based on evidence. And no one can ever know at the end of the day, because you can never go back and check. So all you're doing really is presenting a compelling argument based on the physical evidence and also something that ties in potentially with the documentary evidence. Doesn't always, of course. Sometimes you get archaeological evidence that will contradict the written evidence. However, all we're trying to do is logically make sense of what we find in the ground. I don't think at any point we can give the definitive answer, really. You know, we can say, this is what's in the ground, this is what we think. But, you know, people may come along in the future and take work that we've done and reinterpret it. That's kind of the beauty of archaeology, in that once you've done a project and you've archived all the material, it becomes accessible to anyone in the future. Much as we do today with antiquarian type work or even work from, say, the 20th century, where we'll go back to sites and we'll reinterpret them and we'll say, oh, this person, you know, they thought it was this, but actually they were completely wrong and it was this. I'm certain in the future people will do the same with battlefields. Techniques will develop, you know, methods of dating things will get better or testing things, you know, the chemical signature of lead or something. You know, things like that will improve over time, and that might add new dimensions into the interpretation. So, yeah, I think as long as we're aware of all of that and don't put it on a pedestal and say this is the answer, it can never be changed. You know, it's just the answer that we've come up with.
Brilliant. I mean, that's, yeah, looking forward to seeing what's going to happen is brilliant. I'm just wondering, looking back then, so far in your career, what have been like the standout moments? What have you been your most enjoyable memories or finds, particular items maybe?
Well, I mean, working on the Waterloo project really has been a highlight for me. It was one of those sites that I was always interested in. I'm sure I'm not alone in this with you guys.
No, I'm afraid not. You know, we're with you there.
Exactly. So, working there has just been a real privilege and a real kind of boyhood dream, you know. I similarly watched a lot of Sharp when I was a kid and all that kind of stuff. Another site that I was very excited to work on was Bosworth. I was part of a small survey a few years back where we just did a little bit on part of the battlefield. But I managed to find an enormous great medieval cannonball that had been fired during the battle. That was, you know, it was almost the size of a small melon, you know, it was quite large. And that was just an amazing moment to see that and to know that I was the first person to see it, you know, since the person who put it down the muzzle of the gun. That was pretty amazing. And in a slightly non-battlefield, but still systematic metal detecting sort of site, I was very privileged a good long while ago now to work on the Staffordshire Hoard site, which I don't know if you guys know anything about that, but it's basically a load of Saxon gold that was found up in Staffordshire, funnily enough. And I wasn't part of the main excavation when they first found it, but a few years later, they ploughed the field for the first time. And of course, ploughing will churn things up a little bit. And we came in to basically pick up anything that was left that had been missed in the initial excavation. We found, you know, a good few bits and pieces, including the other cheek piece from the helmet, that they found one of the cheek pieces in the main excavation and loads of other little bits of the helmet. And we found the corresponding one from the other side of the helmet. It wasn't me that found it, but it was just amazing to be there, you know, and to see this. Gold is amazing when it comes out of the ground, because it's just the same as when it went in. Basically, it's bright and vibrant. And to see this thing come out of the ground, it was an amazing moment.
Yeah, I mean, gold doesn't tarnish, does it? Unlike everything else. So, you know, you dig it up, dust it off, and there it is. What about anything on your hit list, so to speak? Is there anything that you look at and go, yeah, I'd really like to go there and do X, Y, and Z?
Yeah, I mean, Waterloo would have been on there, but to be honest, I would love to look at some of the Peninsular War sites, some of the siege sites. I'm quite interested in, you know, siege works and things like that, where people are digging these temporary siege works during different sieges and trenches and things like that. I'm kind of interested in all that sort of stuff. So
that's like Ciudad Rodrigo, Badajoz.
Exactly. Yeah. I'd love to have a look at some of those sites. Yeah. That would be amazing. Slightly earlier with my sort of interest in the late medieval period and artillery and things like that, hence the excitement at the Cannonball from Bosworth. I'd really like to look at some of the Swiss Burgundian war sites from the 1470s. In Switzerland. There's some enormous battles there with loads and loads of artillery, and they're just, no one's ever looked at them as far as I'm aware, and there'd be loads of stuff there to find. And the Burgundian army is exceptionally advanced for the time. They don't win many battles, weirdly, but it's they're almost like a pike and shot army in the late medieval period. You know, they've got pikes, they've got loads and loads of cannons, they've got handguns, all sorts of stuff. So I'd love to go and do some of those as well, but it's just getting the money, isn't it, and the funding.
It always comes down to funding and money.
It does, unfortunately. Yeah, I just need to win the lottery or find some sort of sugar daddy or something.
Okay, I mean, I don't know if we can help with that. But if anyone is a sugar daddy and wants to sponsor you online, where can they find out more information about? And let's face it, hopefully more about the archaeological work rather than...
Yeah, let's make this clear. If you are a sugar daddy, please do not contact me. I have to point people towards, initially, Waterloo Uncovered, an amazing project doing amazing archaeology with military veterans, modern veterans, at Waterloo, waterloouncovered.com. Check it out on all the social medias as well. If anyone is interested in stuff that I do, then you're welcome to come seek me out on Twitter or Instagram. It's at Conflict Archeo with an A-E-O at the end. Or indeed on my website, which is battlefieldarchaeology.weebly.com. Yes, I have a free website because I'm cheap.
Nothing wrong with that.
Funny, Marcus and I do this sometimes. We say exactly the same thing at pretty much exactly the same time. We've done it again. There is nothing wrong with a free website. Sam, great to have you back. I know we spoke on the Waterloo Uncovered podcast, but really great to talk to you and hear about your personal experiences. Sugar daddies can go away, but if there are rich benefactors who want to be involved in cutting-edge archaeological work, then I'd urge them to get in touch. And thank you so much for joining us.
No worries. Thanks so much for having me, guys. It's been a pleasure.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.